Welcome to the Clemson Drone Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Burgett from Clemson University. Join me as I dive into the world of drone technology and explore its impact through the eyes of industry leaders. Hear how drone technology directly supports public agencies, private companies, and entrepreneurs from those leading the innovation. If you're a seasoned UAS program manager or just getting into the game, this is a place to learn from the best to help your program soar to new heights. Make sure you subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform so you don't miss a single episode of the Clemson Drone Podcast. At Clemson Drone, the sky is not the limit, it's just the beginning. Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Clemson Drone Podcast. I'm Joe Burgett with Clemson University. I'm very excited to be sharing another conversations here with you. I have on the line Alex Willis of ECS. ECS is a large nationwide company providing a wide range of services in the geotechnical, environmental, and facility spaces. Alex focuses on the geotechnical side, where he uses drones for photogrammetry and LiDAR to support his team, both across the country and coming soon internationally. So with that being said, Alex, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Joe. Glad to be here.
Good deal. Well, Alex, let's kind of start off by just kind of talking a little bit about your background. Can you tell us a little bit about where you're from, where you went to school, and how you ended up at ECS?
Absolutely. So I was born in Colorado and I was raised in Georgia. Right now I'm living in Asheville, North Carolina. And my path through school was a bit non-conventional, kind of a wandering path. I started working when I was 18 in heavy mechanical construction as a laborer and then welder and foreman, and quite quickly found myself kind of in two worlds, which was academic and construction. So part-time through school, I would be spending 10 or 12 hours one day on a shutdown welding, and then the next day I'd head to class. And that kind of influenced me to go from the construction side to the design side. And so my focus became getting an engineering degree and kind of making that transfer, which ended up leading me to ECS. So once I graduated from Southern Polytechnic University in Georgia, aka Kennesaw State University, I started looking around with my girlfriend at where we wanted to live at. Asheville was high on the list, and kind of stumbled into ECS from that.
Oh, it's beautiful country. It's only a couple hours from Clemson. We go up there quite a bit.
Yeah, it's right up in the mountains and just really beautiful, just full of art and like the culture and all that stuff is nice.
Okay, awesome. Well, so, and I mentioned, you know, ECS in the intro, and I kind of give a very high level overview of what the company is all about, but can you dive into it a little bit, maybe talk through some of the services that you guys provide, where you're located, you know, just kind of the overall company structure?
Sure. So it is a large company. We have 80 plus offices across the country, almost 3,000 employees, and it's actually the fastest growing employee-owned engineering firm in the country. So it's hard to drive, especially in the Southeast, it's hard to drive a few hours without passing one of our offices. And we provide engineering consulting and geotechnical and environmental markets. We also do facilities, inspections, construction monitoring, and testing. So we kind of touch a lot of different aspects of the construction process from design to build.
Okay. And when you say construction, like what type of construction do you guys kind of focus on? Is there a specific market you guys like to go after?
Oh, goodness, everything. My personal experience is sitting here in Asheville, so Western North Carolina, and we deal with everything from residential homeowners trying to build in these steep mountains all the way to large industrial plants and commercial hospitality. We do medical. We're kind of all in, you know, if you're putting something on the ground, because I'm in the geotechnical side, we're gonna help people out with that.
Yeah, that encompasses a lot of the buildings that are tied to the ground, right? Yeah. I mean, that's all of them, right?
For sure.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, in another life, I was a contractor, and you know, some of the ones that you'd mentioned, those are tough projects. You know, hospital. I remember medical work being one of the most challenging, maybe not from the geotechnical side, but just being like critical shutdowns and infection control and all that kind of good stuff. So kind of getting ready for the show, we had some discussions and I asked you some questions about ECS and the drone program. And you had talked about how ECS started the drone program. And I remember thinking, well, this is a kind of a very common story. And I think others would kind of appreciate hearing it from you. So can you kind of talk through a little bit about, you know, the stories of how ECS started using drones? How did you guys develop a program? How did it go from
from nothing to something.
Absolutely. It started small, and we're a very large company, but it actually started here in the Asheville office with just one drone and one pilot and Pix 4D and trying to figure out how to use this technology to supplement what we're already doing. And from my understanding, the company actually had decided no drones for a while. It was considered a liability, just a new technology, and eventually became obvious that it could really help us out in a lot of ways.
How long ago was that when the no drone policy was enacted or lifted, or however you want to frame it?
Right. It's just 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago was when we, you know, finally pulled the trigger and got into it.
Yeah. And again, not uncommon. You know, I mean, people in, especially in the construction space, you know, people hear license and airspace and, oh no, you know, and there's immediate aversion to liability, whether it's there or not. So not an uncommon stance. Okay. So you guys moved past the no drone position.
Right.
And how'd you get past that?
Well, it became obvious how much value it could bring us and our customers from efficiency and safety on our side to just higher value deliverables for our customers. And it was really a natural extension of what we already do. For engineering consultants and inspectors, a lot of our job is getting smart people to put boots on the ground and to help the design side and the construction side. So, you know, sometimes it helps to get boots off the ground, you know, high inspections on roofs, or in my case, a lot of mountainous, rugged terrain with thick forests, and we got to mobilize drill rigs through that kind of terrain. And so drones became something that was just an obvious natural extension for us.
Yeah, I'm going to have to remember that expression, boots off the ground. I'm going to have to write that one down. That's a good one.
Right.
So, I mean, you talk about some of the value proposition, but was that hard to sell to your upper management? And I guess I should back up. When you had said that you guys had started the program with one drone and one pilot, that one pilot was not you. You kind of came in a little bit after. Is that right?
Correct. We had an employee who had some experience with drones, and I understand that, you know, just having somebody who had flown drones before and kind of knew what they were doing, it helped give some confidence in giving it a shot. They didn't stick with the company very long, and that's how I actually ended up in the position. I was already working with a lot of the data anyways, GIS data and LiDAR data and stuff like that, so I would help them with the back end of the drone stuff. When they left and we had the equipment, it was an opportunity for me to get in there and become a pilot and then further education and training and help grow the program from there.
So what was the first drone? And then it just came to mind, so just to confirm, you weren't that one guy, but were you there? You were
yes.
Part, at least tangentially, a part of that decision-making process.
I was, yep.
Okay, awesome. And then what was the first drone that you guys purchased?
Oh yeah, it's probably a common story as well, but we got the Phantom 4 Pro RTK.
I was about ready to say, that's it, you know, it. And well, you got the RTK, so you were even one more step above. Usually it's the Phantom 3, the Phantom 4, some iteration of the Phantom 4, V2, you know, whatever it happens to be. Okay, well, awesome. So you had someone come on board, had a little bit of a background, you know, and you were there. Was it difficult to sell to management to start a drone program? What were some of the barriers? You know, what were some of maybe the tangible things that you can say, hey, look, we need a certain amount of money, you know, so we need a few thousand dollars or at least to buy the equipment. What was the discussions like to be able to sell the value to upper management?
Sure. So one thing to keep in mind about the company is we've been around for about 30 years, and new technology is not necessarily a big thing for us to overcome. So we've adopted different technology over time that was new and we didn't know how to approach it, but now we use it every day. So it wasn't necessarily a difficult sell from my understanding, but it was a careful sell because it's now that we're going to do this, how are we going to approach it? And luckily ECS has a goal of being a premier engineering firm. So we do want to be on the leading edge. And we also just have the luck of great, you know, upper management. Our director of strategic initiatives, Matt Fogelman, which has been great getting the drone program implemented and developing policies. And so having that support on the upper end, having a company that's willing to invest And then having the local expertise and ability to build that foundation is what helped us launch.
Yeah. You know, anytime you have a company that has a position for like director of strategic initiatives, right. that just screams forward looking, right?
Absolutely.
And I mean, you guys are a large firm, so you're able to have a position that's focused on that. But even for entrepreneurs or smaller companies, even if it's not a full-time position, I have found if there's like somebody that management comes to and says, look, you know, we need for you to be spend a certain percentage of your work week focusing beyond, you know, like 2, 3, 5, 10 years beyond, and kind of figuring out the best that you can where this industry is heading, and be more strategic thinking than operationally thinking, you know. And again, that's true for big companies and innovative companies like ECS, and then small companies, you know, that might just have a handful of employees.
Oh, absolutely. Even just a single employee, you know, or a single proprietor of a company, they're going to spend some time doing that. So.
Right. Yeah, no, and sometimes when I mentioned entrepreneurs, I mean, they can be in the trap of always being looking 10 years away, and that there's danger with that. But then you can have the reverse of everyone looking 2 weeks away, and there's dangers with that too. Okay. So that all makes sense. And you had said leading edge. And when I was a contractor, we were very cognizant of that too, that we wanted to be on the leading edge also, but not the bleeding edge, right? So yeah. You didn't want to be the first person to adopt something and bear all of the R&D cost. You wanted to be close to there, and where those costs were absorbed by other companies, and then you could take advantage of it. And I think at this point, especially with the mass adoption of drones, I mean, it's hard to imagine anybody, you know, not saying the technology doesn't have an ROI and all of that. Would you kind of agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. And for a while, the technology was very expensive. It was very unknown. Even the regulations were just changing so quickly. It was hard to feel confident, I think, for some people to invest. But now that it's becoming affordable, the FAA is slowing down some of their changes. They're figuring some of this stuff out. Same thing on the state and local level. It's something that is much more approachable.
Yeah, no, I agree. Things have kind of normalized. There haven't been any big or forecasted big changes on the FAA side. I mean, when visual line of sight part 108 rolls out, that'll be a bigger deal, but we're not there yet. So I think we can kind of rest easy. So let's talk a little bit about where your program is now. So again, you got a fairly large company, you know, how many pilots do you have now? Where are the drones located? How is it organized? How is your drone program, you know, kind of administrated?
Yeah, we have probably 6 authorized pilots. We have a lot of people who have, they're 107, but we have 6 authorized pilots. And
yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. You're not unique there. Yeah.
Right. Probably 3 or 4 different drones. 2 of them are in our office. The Asheville office is kind of the hub of operations, but we do have other offices that have pilots and are figuring out ways to apply them as well. We use the drones on my side, we use it for geotechnical engineering purposes and environmental. Some other offices are using them for inspections, whether it's building envelope inspections, roof inspections, stuff like that. And that's kind of where we're at now is we're growing. We got a handful of pilots, and we're trying to have some consistency across that and make sure we're heading in the right direction.
A couple of questions there. So I want to talk about the building inspection side just real quick, and then focus a little bit more on what you do. So for the building inspection side, are you guys using, you know, thermography at all, like infrared for any like energy leakage or roof leakage, anything like that?
Yeah, I believe we have one office doing that. They have the Mavic 3T. So they're doing, and you know, just let me preface this, we've been doing thermography for a while. So the technology is changed from in the hand to in the sky. But it's something our facilities,
well said.
Right. So we do building inspections, thermography, and with our facilities part of the company.
Okay. So let's focus a little bit on what you do. Okay. So I know you're on the geotechnical side. So what equipment do you have? What types of missions do you fly? What data do you collect? And then what kind of decisions does that help you make?
Right. So we have, we still have the Phantom 4. That thing is putting in some work.
It's my favorite. It's my favorite. They don't make it anymore. It's still my favorite aircraft.
It's great. We also have the Matrice 350 RTK, and that's what we have for our LiDAR payload. So personally, and what our office is doing is I'm the most senior pilot right now, so I'm helping if somebody has a new idea, even if it's on the inspection side for facilities, you know, I'm going to help with those flight plans and getting things organized, deliverables, approaches. But what we're using the drones for primarily is supplementing our engineering design side. So geotechnical is where it's at for me. And we're taking the drones and using them to get more information about the geometry of design jobs, whether it's a landslide in the mountains or a retaining wall that fell over or, you know, a fresh site. We're using them to get an idea of the forest and the density of vegetation for field reconnaissance purposes. And we're also using them to just have the ability to get a new perspective and share with interior. You know, we may have an expert in another state. We need their opinion on this. And it's just very easy for us to share a 3D model with them and have them there on the job site with us virtually instead of flying them all the way out. So it's kind of connecting the dots interior, getting the ground geometry data and the structure geometry data and connecting those dots.
Now, you had said that you had kind of used a couple of scenarios like landslides and where a retaining wall had failed, but then you also said that you use it for fresh sites as well. Is there either one of those kind of groupings that's more valuable? Like, for example, you know, I would imagine if you're like in a fresh site where you've got, you know, just kind of wide open space, you might have plenty of access to get the dimensions you need, or maybe not. But then if you're talking about rock slides, you know, I don't know much about those, but that sounds like you might be in kind of a more unstable location, and there's more, you know, there could be some safety hazards and stuff there. So is it kind of across the board that you're using this technology, or are there specific use cases that lend itself well that, hey, this project is like a slam dunk, this tool's the right tool. This one, maybe, it kind of depends on situations.
There are definitely projects that are a slam dunk for us where we know we need a drone out here. If it's difficult access, if it's hazardous access, if in a normal situation, if we don't have the data going into it, it's really nice for us to be able to show up with the drone and come back to the office with a lot of data. For a landslide, for example, you may have tension cracks in the ground that somebody could, you know, potentially fall in. It doesn't always get that bad, but you're working with unstable terrain and thick forest vegetation. In a retaining wall situation, previously we might have an engineer go out and take some measurements with a tape, takes a tape measure and get a bunch of pictures, and that works okay, but you just can't physically access all the things that would be great to know about. And you don't always remember in the field to get all the data that you really need. So in a situation where we have very little information going into it, access is tricky, or we know what we need to get out of it from a design perspective, that's where we're definitely going to bring the drone.
Yeah. So, and we don't have enough time to really go through the details and the differences between photogrammetry and LiDAR. I mean, photogrammetry, you're might create meshes, models, and maps and point clouds based off of images. Where LiDAR, you're creating point clouds based off of lasers that go back and bounce back and creating a point cloud that way. Are there, you know, again, there's a lot to my next question, but from a high level, what goes into the decision making for you guys about whether to use photogrammetry with your Phantom 4 RTK or to use the M30 and your LiDAR unit?
Well, without going into too much detail about the different processes, I could say in general, if it's more of an open site and we're not having issues with vegetation, stuff like that, we're going to go towards photogrammetry. And you also just get a lot of photos out of that. So if we need to be able to look closely at something in high resolution later on, photogrammetry helps us out. If it's thickly vegetated area, we're trying to see what's beneath that vegetation or see features that are difficult to even notice when you're there on site, we're going to go with LiDAR. And working with the LiDAR data, it can be a little bit different than photogrammetry, but you still end up with point clouds for each. So the deliverable is the data ends up looking similar, but the ability to penetrate that vegetation is usually what drives our LIDAR.
Gotcha. So, and I had kind of teased this when I introduced you to the top of the show, is that, you know, most of your drone program now is domestic in the United States, but you guys have acquired a government contract for an island country. So outside of Part 107 rules, what goes into that? You know, like I know you're familiar with Part 107, I'm familiar with Part 107, but if I'm asked to go fly a mission internationally, well, that's uncharted waters for me. So what goes into that process for you for being able to ask to collect data someplace that is not on U.S. soil?
Yeah, there's a lot going into it, and I'm personally still learning. There's logistically a lot going on there. So does the place you're going have internet? Does it have, if you're using a network instead of RTK, does it have network coverage? How are you going to get the data from there? And then on a regulation side, what do they want to see? What are their regulations for flying? I'm noticing that sometimes they may reference U.S. regulations, but again, there's no FAA. So it's really important if you're looking at an area that's not within the U.S. territory to find out, you know, where they're at. And it may not end up being easy to learn. You may have to make some phone calls. You may have to talk to some people who are in the government and figure out, you know, what are you requiring? What do you want to see? And it may be new for them too. So,
right. Yeah. It may not be on a website like it is for us, where that information can be accessed remotely. I mean, it might be, as you just said, to pick up the phone and hopefully you find the right person,
right,
for them to tell you where to go.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I have seen too that, you know, same thing that you just mentioned, a lot of times it's other countries adopt Part 107, and it works for like 90% of the time, but there's things in Part 107 that references a US-based system. Well, if that US-based system isn't there, then what's the substitute? And no one's thought through it, you know, so
right.
It can be a challenge. And again, I have not done international flights, but my advice when someone asks me, which is always dangerous, someone asks me for advice on something I've never done before, that's always dangerous.
Right.
But my generic advice is always like, be a good neighbor. You know, what's the intent? What's the spirit here? And then try to do that and avoid getting in trouble that way. So one kind of final question here for you as we kind of wrap things up here. If there was another organization, doesn't have to be geotechnical, but another, we'll say construction related firm, right? Maybe a contractor, subcontractor, you know, whatever, engineer, whatever. And they have an interest in starting a drone program. What would be your advice to them about a way to start it responsibly, assuming they do have, you know, buy-in from upper management, at least conceptually, maybe a little bit of money to spend, not nothing huge, but something to get started. What would be your advice for that person or that group of people that want to start a UAS program at their company?
My first advice would be pull the brakes a little bit, slow down, and even though you haven't started, you're probably very eager to get into this, spend some time looking around, see what other companies are doing, how they're approaching it. If you can get your hands on some operation manuals, go for that. Just see what's happening out there, how the technology is being applied. It's new, but a lot of this stuff is being done, and it may be new for you, but you can learn a lot by seeing what other companies are doing, or maybe tuning into a Clemson podcast and listening to how other people.
Nice plug.
Right.
Very nice.
So that would be my general advice, is to just try to start out right, because it seems risky to have a rushed approach to it. And it's just, maybe this is just the engineer in me, but taking the time, figure out your plan and just make sure you're heading in the right direction from the beginning. That being said, you know, don't be afraid to invest. Like, you don't want to buy the cheapest stuff out there. You don't want to take the cheapest approach. Education is a big part of that. Training is a big part of that. Equipment. So make sure you're heading in the right direction and making smart investments.
Yeah, no, I like that. I mean, it's really hard to argue with the advice about just, you know, having things not be emotion driven, but stop back, look at what's available, make data-driven decisions and not avoid risk, because there's risk in everything, but manage that risk and always compare that to the potential reward that's out there. And I think you're right. I mean, drones are new, but they're not brand new. I mean, there's lots and lots of stuff that's out there that you could borrow and see what's worked and look at what your competitors are doing and what other peer industries are doing. So I think, Alex, that's really good advice. So we'll end it here. Alex, this has been great. Thank you so much for sharing your insights with us and spending some time with us.
Thank you so much, Joe. It's been great to chat with you and really enjoyed being here and excited for this industry and listening to this one podcast once it comes out.
All right. Awesome. Well, thank you. And thank all you guys for listening to the Clemson Drone Podcast. You'll hear me do another shameless plug that if you're staring at your phone or whatever, go ahead and hit that like button or subscribe button, you know, especially with this being so early on in the process, that really does help out with the old algorithm. So if you do that, we would greatly appreciate it. But with that being said, we'll be back on the air in another 2 weeks with another great guest. We'll start talking a bit more about photogrammetry and LiDAR. So with that being said, thanks, everybody, and we'll see you next time.